You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 102.7 FM.
I wrote this series for Rabble, and I'd sort of been thinking about going on this birthright trip for a while, and I was aging out. I'm 26. I'm going to be 27 in March, and that's the cutoff for birthright. And I'd been thinking about doing this, but I was sort of just like, oh, you know, next year. And then I thought, well, you know, it's my last year, maybe I should do it, but I sort of needed a reason if I was going to go and do it. So I pitched this series to Rabble, and they said, okay. So I wrote this series, and I wrote this series, obviously, without telling the people at Birthright that I was going to be doing that. And I actually finagled my way onto an American trip out of New York, because I wanted to fly out of New York. And so I'm going to read you some excerpts from various chunks and sort of show you some photos of what was going on as we went. So this is from the very first entry that I did, arriving in Tel Aviv day one. I arrive at the Newark airport just outside New York at 10 a.m. on a hot day in late June and stumble around, exhausted from the past day of traveling from Vancouver, trying to find my group. Gathered together by the organizers, our first team icebreaker has us tell the group of 40 our names, city of residence, and describe the theme of our bar or bat mitzvah. I didn't have a bat mitzvah. Well, then tell us what your theme would have been if you'd had one, says one of our 25-year-old very friendly guides. I'm Rachel Marcuse, or Rachel 4 of 5, I say, a little shocked that there are 5 Rachels on the trip. I mean, it does seem a little bit excessive, even for such a common name. I'm from Vancouver. I'm the token Canadian bump from another trip. I'm happy to be with you guys. I guess my theme would have been dancing if I'd had a bat mitzvah. It turns out I'm not the only one who hasn't gone through the Jewish rite of passage. For those who are officially Jewish adults, the most popular theme for those born between 1983 and 1985 was unquestionably Under the Sea. So, you know, good job, Disney, between 1983 and 1985. At the first El Al airline security check, and El Al is the national airline of Israel, which Birthright uses, I'm bombarded with rapid-fire questions all examining my Jewishness. No, I don't know my Hebrew name. Why am I going on this trip? To see Israel? Don't say Palestine, I repeat in my head to myself. How do I celebrate high holidays? Well, I'm really more culturally Jewish. But my parents met in Israel when they were both working for dance companies in Tel Aviv. The questioner looks dubious. Most participants get one interrogator. I get two. The guy that told the interrogator that he was an atheist got 3. The fact that I'm on Taglit Birthright seems to be my saving grace. Taglit, or birthright as it's translated from the Hebrew, is my gift from the Jewish people. It's also a free trip to the Middle East, 10 days in Israel, all expenses paid, save for some lunches and tips. Taglit is funded by North American Jewish organizations, philanthropists, and the Israeli government. Offering this information, interestingly enough, wins me 100 shekels for snacks in a Q&A at the orientation session, although perhaps unsurprisingly, everyone receives the money in the end. Taglit seems to have the ultimate aim of convincing young North American Jews to make aliyah, that is, to ascend to the homeland, or at least take a more active role in their Jewish communities at home, presumably in a way that will support the State of Israel. As a progressive, secular, non-Zionist Jew, I hadn't thought much about doing Birthright, or at least figured I could always do it the next year. Now, 26, however, it's the last year I'm eligible. I struggle with the decision to go. It's free for me, but do I even want to contribute in a small way to the Israeli economy? We later learn that the contribution isn't so small. Taglit injects some $500 million into the Israeli economy each year. I go into the experience with an intention to bear witness and ask questions. After all, what could be more Jewish? I'll write about Birthright and extend my visit to Palestine and see if I can be of some use. Plus, as I learn, it's the reason why a lot of people go, it's a free trip. So here I am on El Al on my way to Tel Aviv. Amazingly enough, economy class is full and I'm bumped up to executive class. I figure it might be good travel karma for my bad trip the day before, a day of luggage delays and a missed flight. Sadly, I don't get to partake of the excessive booze options. Even ice wine is served on El Al Executive, just in case anyone goes, as Birthright prohibits drinking on the plane. I figure it's too early to start being a troublemaker. After arriving for orientation, according to the straight-up Denver-born director, this Taglit trip provider prides itself on plurality. Apparently, this is the only trip provider that builds in a visit to an Arab village to talk about coexistence. There will be no visit to Palestine itself, though, and no Palestinian perspective included in any shape or form. I immediately sense that there will be many attempts to out-reasonable us. There will be no obvious brainwashing here. So that's just an excerpt from the first entry. So this is when we just got on the bus. This was the bus that was going to essentially be our home with 40 Jews for the next 10 days. The guy from Denver, the guy who ran the program, was pretty funny. And when we were there for the orientation, he sort of said, "So who's worried about being on a bus for 10 days?" And like most people put up their hands. "Who's worried about being on a bus with 40 Jews for 10 days? And like people put up their hands. "Who's worried about getting bombarded by propaganda?" And like four of us put up our hands. So this was our view, our very, very first view from the bus when we arrived at 7:30 a.m. And they took us all the way up to the Golan Heights that first day. So you start with a bang, and they take you, and it's all, you know, very biblical looking, and they take you up there. And that's the view right from the top of the Golan Heights in, well, Syria, although it's Israel now. So that was sort of day one. We got to experience that. It wasn't until 8 p.m. that we actually made it to the kibbutz that we were staying at in the north. Day three. After dinner, we all sit outside in the lovely courtyard of the kibbutz hotel. The accommodations for our trip are all shockingly comfortable and expensive, and are asked to share our comments about our connection to Judaism or whatever, our leader quickly adds. Many of the participants come from interfaith families and consider themselves culturally or spiritually Jewish as opposed to religious. I decide to out my politics, but gently. I describe myself as not religious, perhaps spiritual. I describe my parents meeting in Israel, the history of my family in the Holocaust. I mention that the most religious person in my family was originally Catholic. It's true, my aunt, she was Catholic. She's really Jewish now. She works at the JCC, in fact. I say that one thing I like about Judaism is the focus on asking questions. I tell the group that I make no secret of my issues with Israel, but I'm approaching the trip with a desire to question how oppression operates within Israel and Palestine and want to invite others to do the same. This is probably the first time anyone has said the P word. It's been referred to as the situation or the conflict up until this point. My contribution shifts the conversation a little, but then it moves on to talk about Jewish stereotypes. After the discussion, relaxing at the kibbutz bar, a couple of other progressives out themselves to me, thanking me for saying what I said. Eventually, we become a 4-to-8-person propaganda debrief group, huddling together after some of the more particularly problematic pluralistic sessions. While I don't think any of the participants would describe themselves as activists, we do become a critical mass of folks able to provide some support to each other and to a lesser extent to the group as a whole. This night becomes the first of many heavy drinking/bonding evenings with a group of 40 surprisingly interesting people. During the trip, I come to realize that nearly all of my prejudices, assumptions, and snap judgments about individuals on the trip have dissolved. I don't go to bed until 4 a.m. This is a guy up north, and at one point we went to go and visit him, and at one point he's a mystic, right? He follows Kabbalah, and he got us to yell at the top of our lungs, "I love Israel," and I just sort of closed my eyes and sat there, and it was awkward, and that was fine. But interesting guy. So he was one of the sort of the people that we got introduced to, and we got introduced to. All very, very charismatic people, let's just say. So I'll introduce you to some of them in a little bit. So day five. So at this point, the soldiers have been with us for a couple of days for our mifgash, because part of the whole birthright thing is that you're hanging out with, like, regular Israeli youth is the idea. So we had 6 soldiers/students join us, which obviously makes criticism a little bit harder for people. So the soldiers have been with us. And this is an excerpt right from after we'd been talking about the flotilla, the Gaza flotilla. So these soldiers, kids really, significantly younger than me, are under immense pressure since childhood to participate in a conflict that many of them found at the least problematic and sometimes despicable. But for most, the army creates an enveloping sense of obligation, of social cohesion, and of solidarity, which can make critical expression very difficult. This reluctance to criticize was especially evident in discussion around the Gaza flotilla. The soldiers who are on those ships and helicopters are the friends, literally or figuratively, of the soldiers who accompanied us on our trip. They were commanded by the state to be there in international waters. There was no question in the minds of the soldiers with whom I spoke that their comrades were defending themselves against pipes and in fear of lynching. I pointed out the disproportionate force used, pipes versus guns, but my arguments were useless in the face of this seemingly unshakable social cohesion. Every Israeli Jew I talked with about the flotilla became immediately defensive. This reaction led me to realize how self-conscious Israelis are. Many deeply care about what the international community thinks about them and their country. Many even agreed that Israel policy had the unintended consequence of increasing anti-Semitism around the world, but there was still an overwhelming sense of social cohesion and national unity clearly tied to military service. I realized, too, that something similar was happening with us on Taglit. There was an attempt to create a similar sense of community and social cohesion in our group. We were sleep-deprived, culture-shocked, and vulnerable. Taglit, it seemed, wasn't really about convincing us about the politics, but about creating a sense of community that we would associate with Jewishness and then with Israel. The sense of community was real, but the assumptions that followed weren't necessarily so. Thinking about these things, I came up with what I call the birthright equation. Jewishness plus community equals I heart Israel. Social cohesion was clearly manifest in our newly built community. Many on the trip, I speculated, would equate the genuine warmth and respect in the group with Jewishness, as opposed to, say, humanness. And these positive feelings would all connect back to Israel. My equation would become a little longer over the coming days as I heard the same chorus from Israeli after Israeli, "It's complicated." So this is one of the other interesting people that we met. This woman, Princeton educated, an artist. She's now a glass blower, and she talked about her experience making Aliyah to the homeland, making her return to the homeland. This is when we went down to the Negev. We went to a Bedouin village. We ended up naming it Bedouin Disneyland because it was sort of a tourist show. But it was neat. We got to ride on camels, so that was cool. So this is mid-trip now. So I'm taking you now to day 10, last day. So we're done. We've been with the soldiers for a couple days now, and they've taken off for our final wrap-up session with this guy from Denver who runs the program. So our Denver-born, no-nonsense director returns for our wrap-up session. I corner him after and ask him the question I have continually raised. If this is a pluralistic trip, why no Palestinian perspective? It's not the donor's agenda, he responds quickly. I'm floored. This is not the directness that I'm expecting. He immediately backtracks when I ask what the agenda is, and he talks about the diversity of opinion from the founders and donors, how for some the program is about making Aliyah, which seems to be Israelis' notion about why the program exists, and having lots of Jewish babies. But for others, it's just about strengthening Jewish identity and realizing that one's assumptions about Israel might be wrong and that it's complicated. Thus, I expand my birthright equation. Jewishness plus community equals I heart Israel, yield, it's complicated, yield, make Aliyah, brackets, or at least support Israel at home. Is the donor's agenda successful? In general, I would say yes, very. The Taglit program is very intelligently run and must be showing results to justify the millions of dollars spent, tax dollars, of course, and 1/5 of the population is Arab, who are also paying for it. I mean, I got bat mitzvahed. So you'll have to actually read my series to hear about how I got bat mitzvahed, because I actually got bat mitzvahed. I call it my birthright haze, and I got bat mitzvahed. So I renewed my commitment to anti-oppression work through my bat mitzvah, but still, I got bat mitzvahed. So it had an effect on me. The program uses classic techniques like sleep deprivation, control over agenda and movement, even timing in when we could pee, culture shock, isolation from media, and tightly controlled contact with people from outside the group, all of whom, as I've described, were not exactly a representative sample of Israeli society. There was little space for dialogue, little context about the history of the state and the occupation for those who had less of a background, and formats made it hard to be critical with the group present, which was especially tough because everyone was so exhausted. They literally had us in the bus from like 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. every night. These techniques were likely much more successful than trying to convince us on real politics, of which many of the participants weren't interested in too much anyway. Nearly everyone in the group I talked to now felt a connection to Israel, where many had felt none prior to the trip. Tagleit Birthright hopes this will translate into support for Israel policy at home in the U.S. and in Canada. For most, I think it probably does, especially for the younger 18-year-old groups who go with higher propaganda trip providers, of which most of the Tagleit trips are. Birthright plays into our legitimate desire for community and exaggerates emotional reactions to people and places due to the high-intensity experience. Even I had to continually remind myself that what we were experiencing as people, not just as Jews. And then we'd all go out and get trashed. So that's the end of the Birthright chunk, and I'll just give you a little bit of a sense of sort of what happened afterwards. What do we got? This is the Wailing Wall, and looking over to the men's section. The men get like 3 times the space, and they get some underground air conditioning space to read the Torah too, which I thought was super fair. This was our last night, so everyone just got totally drunk the last night. And we were the old group, like we were the mature group. So you can only imagine when you've got like 18-year-olds away from home for the first time. They're just drunk the whole time. It was the bar the last night. So after Birthright, I set up some interviews both in Israel and in the West Bank. I met with a really interesting Arab advocacy organization called Masawa. I encourage you to look them up. They work with Arab Israelis in the state of Israel specifically. So a young bar owner at a nonpartisan place down the street, most of the bars in this neighborhood seem to have political affiliations, tells me that tension breeds dialogue. We're in Haifa right now, which is one of the most integrated places, people tell me. This might be the case in Haifa, where there is a relaxed level of tolerance for political difference, but it doesn't feel that way in other places I visit. Typically, I feel space for tolerance is privileged for Jews over Arabs. Jews are allowed the luxury of dialogue, while Arabs are thought of as terrorists and too often all but excluded from discussions around a peace process. There was also an interesting distinction between discussion that occurs within Israel and discussion originating from outside the country, whether within the Jewish diaspora or the international community as a whole. Progressive North American Jews are becoming accustomed to being labeled self-hating and are subject to a special level of venom when criticizing Israel or asking provocative questions about the conflict. I have received some lovely hate tweets on Twitter since writing this series along these lines. The hostility I've faced has largely come from other North Americans. Israelis seem to appreciate that I was genuinely listening and able to shift my opinions, but there is nonetheless an underlying sense that criticism should stay within Israel. Near the end of my trip, I'm back in Tel Aviv, staying with one of the soldiers from the group. He and some friends are watching the World Cup, while I, not a soccer fan, chat with some friends on Facebook and respond to an email from a person from Breaking the Silence, with whom I've been corresponding. Breaking the Silence is made up of soldiers who have been stationed in Hebron. These soldiers now give tours of the city, illustrating the horrific treatment of the resident Palestinians by the small group of fundamentalist Jews who have settled in the town. During a lull in the soccer game, I ask one of my friends what people think of the Breaking the Silence soldiers. It's good what they're doing, he says, and adds that most Israelis think the situation in Hebron is really bad and should be fixed. But, he says, Israelis also think, don't ever do these tours in English. So just as with a family reluctant to wash its dirty linen in public, it seems that dialogue can be good and useful, but it also needs to stay in the tent, and a Jewish-Israeli tent at that. I visited a community center, an arts community center, in the Aida refugee camp just outside of Bethlehem in the West Bank. Two of the staff members, Murad and Ahmed, both in their early 20s, take us on a tour of the UN-administered refugee camp. We see kids filling containers with water at a pump because we are told you never know when the Israelis are going to turn off the water. We wander through a housing camp compound and are quickly offered tea by several residents. This is typical. Throughout the West Bank, we are offered tea and coffee constantly. Everyone, it seems, wants to sit down and tell us their story. We hear something from this family that we hear echoed in stories from many Palestinians. We're not stereotypes. That is, we're not terrorists. It's interesting that this thought is articulated so clearly and in English at that. It almost feels like many of the folks we talked to have received media training, but perhaps it's more about practicality. Palestinians' very livelihood in many ways depend on support from the international community, and everyone takes the opportunity to talk to a foreigner, especially if she's writing about them. Later in the day in Ramallah, we meet other folks who really do get media training. These are the activists with the International Solidarity Movement. ISM is a Palestinian-led movement committed to resisting the Israeli apartheid in Palestine by using nonviolent direct action methods and principles. This is from their website. Founded by a small group of primarily Palestinian and Israeli activists in August 2001, ISM aims to support and strengthen the Palestinian popular resistance by providing the Palestinian people with two resources, international solidarity and an international voice with which to nonviolently resist an overwhelming military occupation force. I'm interested in why the activists are here. The response from the half dozen young people we meet, all between 22 and 30, my age, is that the movement connects directly to them. They feel that their home governments are complicit in oppression of the Palestinians and that they had to do something. A sense of justice comes out in the conversations. Hassan, that's his code name, they all have code names because they're harassed so much by the IDF, a former business consultant from London, explains his decision to come to the West Bank. First, my government supports and legitimizes the crimes of the Israeli state. Second, the conflict is a key source of geopolitical conflict in the world. It's up to citizens of the world to stop it when the solution is so simple. So I heard lots of it being complicated in Israel. I heard lots of it's not so complicated when I was in Palestine. So this is me under the water. I was actually outside a settlement in East Jerusalem. I didn't realize I was outside a settlement in East Jerusalem. I was actually on the settlement. Because some of the checkpoints in Israel are very obviously checkpoints. Like there are people with guns. You have to go through, you know, barbed wire fences. They check your passports. But in East Jerusalem, where there's the creepage of the settlements, it's not so clear. So this is when we went on a walk with one of the soldiers who I'd been staying with, who was on the trip with us. And when we came back a couple of days later, we left, Hannah and I left our stuff there when we went to the West Bank. And when we went back, we were driving. And I said to him, I said, hey, Orr, are we driving east? And he said, yeah. And I said, are we beyond the green line? He said, yeah. I was like, so your parents kind of live on a settlement? He was like, oh, no, my parents do live on a settlement. I was like, oh, because I hadn't realized. It's really hard to tell because of the way that the creepage is happening now. So this is my last little bit. So I'm in Hebron now. My discomfort increases as I begin to more fully understand the situation, a situation which is almost literally on top of me. I look up at a net hanging above the shuk. The shuk is the market. It's full of garbage and other debris. The Jewish settlers, who number about 500, have built homes above both sides of the market street. I am told that the net is to protect the Palestinians below from the garbage, urine, eggs, and bleach routinely thrown at them by the settlers. I can see evidence of the refuse in the net right above me. One of the shopkeepers shows me egg stains on the scarves he is selling. Hebron feels tense. In fact, it's the most tense place I've ever been. There is a lot of history here and a lot of contemporary conflict. Since it's the traditional burial site of Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, and Jacob and Leah, the founders and the fathers and mothers of the Jewish people, it is the second holiest place in Judaism right after Jerusalem. It's also holy for Muslims who worship at the Ibrahim Mosque at the Cave of the Patriarchs. It was here on February 25th, 94, during the overlapping holidays of Purim and Ramadan, that an Israeli settler and member of the far-right Israeli Kash movement opened fire with an automatic weapon. 29 worshippers were killed and 125 wounded that day. When Hannah and I enter the mosque after a security screening and donning long brown robes, we have to say that we're Christian to get in, we can see the bullet holes in the wall. As it's Friday, demonstration day in the West Bank, today might feel even more tense than usual. There is a rally planned for later in the afternoon to protest the closure of Shuhada Street, the main thoroughfare in Hebron, which is reserved for settlers. As a consequence, this closure shut down about 800 Palestinian stores. In the settlers' area, the movement of Palestinians is heavily restricted. The Jewish settlers have total freedom of movement and are protected by the IDF. And they're really protected by the IDF. So there are 500 settlers. Any guesses as to someone who hasn't been there, how many soldiers there are to protect 500 settlers? Guesses? 1,000? 2,000. 2,000 to protect 500 settlers. And many of the settlers, interestingly enough, are American. They're actually not Israeli, and as such, they don't actually have to they don't have the mandatory service in the military, which Israelis often aren't very happy about. So back at the checkpoint now, I didn't make it through another checkpoint because it was closed to internationals for the day. We think probably because it was the protest day in the West Bank. Friday is the demonstration day. So I'm back through the checkpoint. And in English, I ask a soldier the best way to get into town. He asks where I'm from. I tell him, Canada. Where, he says. Vancouver, I answer. Where, he asks again. East Van, I respond. Where? I give him my intersection. I'm from Oak and 41st, he says. Are you Jewish, he asks. I nod. You're not really supposed to be in Bethlehem, he tells me. I know that while parts of Bethlehem are Area A and forbidden to Israelis, I'm not Israeli and figure my Canadian-ness supersedes my Jewishness. He doesn't seem to think so. The soldier takes off his yarmulke, the head covering required of observant Jews, and shows it to me. Embroidered on it is the logo of the Vancouver Canucks. Another assumption dissipates. So that's it. This is the yarmulke. He wouldn't let me take a picture of him, but he let me take a picture of the yarmulke. This is a tear gas canister from when I was interviewing the activists with the International Solidarity Movement. They were telling me that the tear gas canisters were often shot into the crowd as opposed to over the crowd, which is what most of the time happens at demos here. And the tear gas canister is metal, right? So it has a very similar effect to bullets. So this is the net in Hebron. So you can see there's sort of garbage, there's a doll, and you see that there's a sniper up there at the top. And that's it. So thank you for coming.